I want to thank Richard for his introductory comments, and like Linda, I'm a privilege to be here, and my respect for Dan Ellsberg is tremendous, and I think some of that might come out in my comments today. Probably the reason why I was chosen to speak is that for the last close to 5 years now, I've been working at editing the letters of John Kenneth Galbraith for Cambridge University Press. There were over 40,000 letters. I've collected 20,000, and I'm still trying to bring them down. Also, I'm writing a book on the friendship between John Kenneth Galbraith and William F. Buckley, Jr. They turned out to be very, very close friends. And the book focuses primarily on how Ken and also Bill Buckley helped develop the rise of the liberal and conservative movement starting in the 1950s up till their deaths. But what I'd like to comment today is reviewing some of Ken's letters dealing with the issues of security and transparency and his concerns about the Vietnam War, but also to bring out some of the letters of his respect for Dan Ellsberg and what Dan did during his career here. So for years, Ken Galbraith had an ongoing dialogue with Joe Alsop, the American journalist who was a vocal supporter of America's involvement in Vietnam. He realized that logic and facts were not going to work with Joe, and so he turned to wit. In a letter to the editor of the Boston Globe, written on November 6, 1969, Ken wrote, "Dear sir, your jolly old Joe now complains that I speak only to God, and so I don't understand American public opinion about the Vietnam War. He's right, of course, but I only started doing it when I saw what happened to him from speaking only to generals. For myself, I wanted a better class of advice." In another letter to the Boston Globe, dated July 8, 1971, Ken defended Dan Ellsberg from a vicious attack by Joe Alsop. "Dear sir, I see that our gentle friend Joe wants Dan Ellsberg jugged for releasing all those papers. I hope as ever your readers will be tolerant with old Joe. He's been releasing military information, true and contrived, according to the needs and wishes of the generals, for years and years and years, including all those captured documents. He has said the best thing to a monopoly in this line, and a nice thing too. Now comes a lousy amateur, Ellsberg, busting into his game. You wouldn't like it yourself." For Galbraith, his criticism and concern with Joe Alsop and all those generals was that they were wrapped up in an ideology that led to one of the most dismal periods in American history, and later the possibility of annihilation of the human race through a nuclear exchange. The official ideological vision of the 1960s and into the 1980s was that the communist world was a political monolith which needed to be opposed at all costs. This Cold War vision, Galbraith argued, quote, "owed much to the man of the establishment whose eminence in the American legal and business and academic pantheon always substantially exceeded their information," end of quote. In both economics and foreign policy, Galbraith believed the United States was attempting to make decisions on ideological grounds, or what he called conventional wisdom, instead of hard, inescapable reality. Galbraith used the Webster Dictionary definition of ideology: visionary theorizing. In a number of letters, he was concerned that far too much visionary theorizing was done in Washington, instead of accepting the world as it is. The main problem with ideology, he believed, is that it ignores historical change, which means it does not move in parallel with reality. If Galbraith is anything, he was a realist. Maybe this view is associated with his being brought up on a farm and having to deal with the hard, cold task of making a living off the land. His time on the farm also might have influenced his view of the primary goal of a good liberal. which was to replace ideology with reality. As he put it, quote, "Liberals need to be reminded that much that is called liberalism is and has been an elementary accommodation to historical change. Well, the problem of conservatives is being stuck in their visionary theorizing worldview," end of quote. Galbraith strongly believed that the best way to combat ideology and the power structure that went along with it was by getting the truth out there to the people. Given the facts, he would say. This is what Galbraith admired about Dan Ellsberg. His courage to speak truth to power and letting the American people know the reality of things. In a draft letter to the New York Times written on June 17, 1971, Galbraith stated his outrage of how he personally and the American people in general were deceived by the American government over Vietnam and why the release of the Pentagon Papers was important for American democracy. Here are parts of the letter. "Dear Sir, in 1964, with numerous others, I campaigned across the country for Johnson-Humphrey ticket. I was by then considerably concerned over our Vietnam involvement. I spoke principally on the need for military restraint of the irresponsibility of Senator Goldwater's talk about unleashing the Air Force. Johnson said to me he would not follow such a path of destruction. One now discovers that the plans for the bombing already existed and were awaiting an excuse that would, if necessary, be manufactured. Those of us who were making the speeches were patsies, serving usefully because of our ignorance. I do not reflect on such trickery with relish. I hope that all of who were similarly involved have a like reaction." But if one can contain his personal anger, there are further lessons. What if we have learned is that a small group of professionally assured and intellectually myopic men had undertaken deliberately to mislead the Congress, the public, and the people of the world at large as to their intentions, and so far as might be possible as to their actions. They would largely have escaped criticism, if not for the Times and Ellsberg. Whatever the plea, the primary effect of the present court action is to protect what is still undisclosed of this mendacity and duplicity. But this is not all. The further lesson is that we can no longer afford the secrecy which protects such conduct of our public affairs. For against whom is such a secrecy employed? It's not employed against the government of North Vietnam. The papers are replete with references to our desire to make clear our intentions to that government, and the worse of our intentions seem, the better. It was for protection from the Congress, our own people, and our friends that the secrecy was employed that the most casual reading of the papers will make clear. And the thing it protected above all was the freedom to make catastrophic mistakes. For the public had known that the administration was seeking a Gulf of Tonkin resolution in the spring of 1964, or had plans to bomb North Vietnam that autumn, or intended putting a large number of troops with a combat mission in the spring of 1965, there had been a vigorous and bruising debate. Foreseeing and fearing such a debate, the administration might well have reconsidered the action. Or in the wake of the debate, it might have been forced to do so. And in the course of the debate, the very great question, which as the paper showed, none of the strategists, George Bull apart, ever thought to ask, what does this policy lead us? It was a secrecy that made possible our silent and unhampered passage into the quagmire. Our safety lies, and lies exclusively, in making public decisions subject to the test of public debate. But cannot survive public debate, as the experience of Vietnam shows, we must not do, end of quote. So there you have it. A consequence of lack of transparency is having those that are wrapped up with their military ideology defending it by secrecy that can cause great harm to our country. It also leads to an arrogance with the implicit assumption that the American people cannot be trusted with the trust or public debate what is in their interest. In the 1980s, Galbraith wrote that the most frightening aspect of visionary theorizing is when you had two or more groups willing to destroy each other over their vision. Galbraith saw both the United States and the former Soviet Union caught up in an ideological battle that was destructive to both, and possibly the whole world. He mentioned Kremlin's attempt to rescue the failed Marxist regime in Afghanistan, quote, "a country as bitterly disastrous to intruders in the last 200 years as any and all the world," end quote. With the United States, he gave examples of Indochina and Iran. The destruction and hatred against both the former Soviet Union and the United States was based on their inability to see beyond their ideological struggles and come to grasp with reality. It was a point that he made in 1961 to Kennedy, when he was sent to Vietnam on a special mission for the president to find out what was going on. And in the private correspondence which I've gone to, which is just absolutely fascinating with Kennedy, Galbraith pointed out that in Vietnam, and what he called the third world countries, the difference between capitalism and socialism, the ideological question of that time, was profoundly irrelevant to the people living in those regions. What Galbraith argued, what remains vitally important for the people in these countries and regions, is the desire for independence and survival. And the efforts for ideological indoctrination is deeply counterproductive. Galbraith saw our ideological passion in foreign policy leading to another era, the creation of bureaucratic organizations and special interests to support that ideology. In the case of the United States, the organization was the military-industrial complex. The ideological rhetoric of politicians and special interests of large military bureaucracies will do whatever they need to do to protect and sustain expenditures, even to the point of destroying each other with a nuclear exchange. In a number of letters, Galbraith expressed his admiration for Dan Ellsberg, for his vocal opposition in the 1980s against the nuclear madness gripping the world, and Ellsberg's reaffirmation of an international peace movement as the human shield, as compared to Reagan's nuclear shield, against what Galbraith called chaos and madness. As Galbraith said, quote, "we will not be protecting a way of life if there is no life. As between the ashes of communism and the ashes of capitalism, not even the most ardent ideologist will be able to distinguish. Among other reasons, because he also will be dead. With such powerful interests to protect, ideologists will justify any type of behavior and will not tolerate those that question it. To keep its power, it must remain in control and keep its secrets. Those that oppose must be destroyed. The consequence is that governments will pass laws to protect their bureaucracies and special interests for the sake of security to control behavior. In this case, the control lead to annihilation of the human race." End of quote. Galbraith believed our only hope out of this madness is to have foreign policy guided by facts and transparency. Quote again, "we are divided by ideology when we should be united by circumstance. And to resist controlling circumstance is to invite frustration. For in foreign policy to risk destruction, better indeed essential that we leave aside labels, the search for controlling theory, and be guided by what seems to be practical, necessary, but above all, what is consistent with survival," end quote. Well into his 90s, when George W. Bush took the United States to war against Iraq, Galbraith was still scolding us about foreign affairs and lack of to grasp reality. But his words then might provide us with some insights for today. So let me end with them. Quote, "there's a larger issue here. In our time, the economically fortunate countries live peacefully together. It is the poor countries that are committed to conflict, both internationally and at home. Modern industry, communications, travel, the arts, and entertainment all lead to a closer association between countries. For this reason, the modern advanced economy is inherently transnational. Once capitalism was thought to be the source of international competition and conflict, and the capitalists were thought the parent or progenitor of war, now no longer. Instead, it is the poor of the world who destroy each other. That is the tendency of people who have little for which to live. Religion, alas, also plays a part. If life in this world is deprived and painful, it can be believed that in the next life things will be better. This is the risk that the economically more favored and the richer less inclined to run. The lesson is clear. The hope and reality of economic improvement is one of the pacifying influences of our time. Accordingly, we in the fortunate countries must have strongly and effectively in mind those who live in the reverse of our well-being. And now the resources and experience that so favor us, we must extend help. Conscience, if such we have, cannot allow us to ignore the poor either at home or abroad, to be less than concerned, less than gracious, less than generous. And it's thus, our over time, that we will help to assure for others and for ourselves a better and more peaceful world. End quote. Thank you.